For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Good morning, everyone. And how did you get fare getting out of your driveway today? You made it. A bunch of us haven't, apparently, so we'll pray for them. We're doing this series of talks on basically the relevance of the Christian message to our culture today. And last week, we talked about the connection between science and the Bible, which I just think that that's such a very important topic because I'm convinced, having thought about this for into the fourth decade now, that the more we learn about the natural world, the more evidence points to the reality of the existence of the God of the Bible and how the story of the Bible and the story of science continue to mesh together in a pretty profound way. This morning, we're going to shift gears just a little bit, though, and we're going to talk about really probably the most complicated question that humans have ever asked themselves. It's the question of why evil? Where does it come from? What does it mean? And how does God relate to evil? And this is something, you know, that has just basically been on the human mind ever since humans began to think and write and reflect on their own existence and the world around them. I was thinking about that earlier this week as I was putting this message together. What kind of world do we live in? And I thought, what's the image that kind of enables us to think this through? And so I chose a fairly famous painting from the 19th century by a guy named Turner, and it's a picture of the slave ship Zog. And this slave ship, like thousands of slave ships from the 17th century to the late mid-19th century, have a very common story. So in West Africa, one tribal peoples conquer another. Hundreds of people are taken prisoner. Many of those prisoners are then brought to coastal cities, port cities. And in one particular port city in West Africa was a boat, 1776. And on this boat, which was built for about 100 people and human cargo under the floor and a crew of 70, it was a remarkable remarkable event occurred. On the deck began to flow human cargo, not to the 250 that were the basic capacity of the ship, but 450. 450 human beings, against their will, being taken across the Atlantic to the islands of the Caribbean to serve as slaves. On the deck were the crew who were ill-prepared for the extent of the human traffic that they had taken upon themselves. These men who, most of them, were criminals themselves. It's the only way they could find actual work. But it's also true that there was a doctor on board because recent legislation in England and in other parts of Europe demanded humanitarian treatment of this human traffic, shockingly. So the provisions were light, and the ship was heavy, and off into the ocean it went, and it went for several weeks. The amount of human suffering and misery is incalculable. Imagine being chained, arm to arm, for weeks at a time, barely eating, no place to relieve yourself, the smell, the sweat, the hunger. 40% of people taken this way died before they ever reached their destination. One day, the waves of the ocean were quite calm. Everyone was feeling like here's an opportunity just to relax a bit. It's been a rough ride. But by late afternoon, clouds were beginning to come together. A storm was brewing. What they didn't realize is that they had been sitting in the eye of a hurricane. Within hours, it became clear as the seas began to writhe up and down that there was real problem. What are we going to do? And so to make sure that there was going to be no problem from underneath the deck. Nails were pounded into the doors that trapped all 450 of the human cargo in the hull. The crew began to argue and fight with one another about what are we going to do? How are we going to save ourselves should this ship list and begin to fall? And ultimately, it did begin to list. And there was obviously going to be a catastrophe. And as they began to scramble, and some were fighting with others for the possibility of a small boat to make an exit, and others were just not sure what to do, and they were fighting with one another about whose responsibility it was for what. The doctor himself on the ship, trying to meet the physical needs of those who were being badly injured by the constant listing of the boat as they're banging their heads into the mast and so forth. Until finally, well into the evening, it was clear there is no future for this ship. And all 450 slaves, the 70 crew, everyone died, being sunk to the bottom of the sea. And in thinking about this and in thinking about similar things, we've realized maybe in some ways the fate of this ship, like so many others, is a bit of a metaphor for life as a whole. The inhumanity of man to man, the constant jockeying for resources and domination and power, and even the presence of some who were there for so-called humanitarian reasons. But they all suffered the same fate. They're all at the bottom of the sea. And we have to wonder, is that not also the case with life as we experience it? As we look at human history and we see that legacy of inhumanity. And we see even the attempts of those who seek good in the context of the relationships, the damaging relationships that exist between human beings as we vie for whatever resources are available. That in the end, we all suffer the same fate. We suffer and we die. Good morning. It's a cheerful story. You may find ourselves wondering, as many have, how could there possibly be a God? How do we explain this? And I want us to think about that here this morning as sensitively as possible, because I want to understand that the problem of evil is everyone's problem. And I want to suggest to you something and want to defend a thesis here with you today, and which is this: that we can make no sense of evil rationally or personally apart from God. That this is a problem that is everyone's problem, and that really is only one plausible, meaningful, satisfying solution to the reality of evil. A reality that all of humanity faces and that you will face already in your life as well. Only in relation to God can we make sense philosophically and personally of the reality of evil. Let's unpack this a little bit, beginning with the rational side. Let's understand a little bit about evil, and I want to widen the lens a little bit and help us to think together this morning about the question of evil. And let's say that there is no God. Let's just say that all there is nature, just the biosphere in which we live, the physical universe that we inhabit. And in such a world, of course, there can be no such thing as evil. Evil has no meaning because nature itself is neither good nor bad. It just is. We don't say of the lion that stalks its prey on the African savanna as it crouches in the undergrowth, waits for that vulnerable moment, then runs after the prey, jumps on its back, locks its teeth around the throat of its prey, and rips the life out of it. We don't say, "Murder!" No, we say, "That's nature." That's what nature does. Of course. Nature just is. It's not good or bad. It's not right or wrong. And the attempt to draw any kind of moral assessment from nature itself is really an illogical enterprise. It's called the is-ought problem. And let me illustrate what I mean. Here's a fact. Hey, people act selfishly. Think that's true? I think that's true. But then what about a value statement? People should act selfishly. Well, there are certainly some people who believe that that's exactly right. Ayn Rand and people like that, the virtue of selfishness. But we have to ask this question, where does that should come from? It doesn't come from nature. It's something that we are imposing upon nature. And on what basis? From where? Naturalism does not provide for us anything in nature to make that assessment. We say people yearn for freedom. That seems very much a fact. But then to say that people should be free, well, that's a judgment, an evaluation, an assessment, and it has nothing to do with the facts of human existence. It's a moral judgment that doesn't have any rootedness whatsoever in the flow of nature, because nature itself is very much unjust and which limits freedom. Where does the should come from? If we can't find a basis to define and to ground our moral categories, we're left with no language, no concept to understand and to define evil. We say to ourselves, people value their possessions, that's true, and therefore that stealing is evil. Well, but again, really? And on what basis? According to what principle? Who says and why? And nature simply doesn't provide for us any kind of meaningful way to capture that internal sense that we have. That certainly things are just plain right or wrong. That there are real things that are just plain evil. We cannot point to nature as a way to capture that deep and universal human sense. Well, so we may think then that nature, though it's a bad basis for defining evil, but maybe that's just the way it is. And I want to suggest to you that the legacy of trying to build ethics on the basis of nature has a pretty bad record. Just look at the last century. If we think about evolution, for instance, as a model for human society and how we should treat one another, then we quickly begin to realize that the principle of survival of the fittest means that there are certain elements within our society that are not geared for or wired for success, and that they should therefore be weeded out of the gene pool. And then all of a sudden we begin to realize we've lowered ourselves to the level of the most primitive animal existence by pointing to nature as the focal point and ideal for our moral behavior and our definition of good and evil. For many who have sensitively reflected upon this and reflected on it from the standpoint of a basic naturalistic or materialistic framework, an atheistic point of view, they look at the pain and suffering of the world and begin to realize, you know, it's all pretty much a cruel joke. We're thrown into this world without any purpose. We live for an unspecified period of time. Maybe it's short, maybe it's long. Maybe it's full of suffering, and certainly by the end there'll be suffering. And then it's over. It all just seems like a cruel joke, but we've got no one to blame. And that sort of despairing point of view really in many ways has dominated at least the Western world of the second half of the 20th century as we've reflected as a culture on the horrific century that we created and wondered what purpose could our lives possibly serve. My friends, I want to just make it very clear to you this. No matter what you believe here this morning, one of the things that you have to understand is that if you accept the basic proposition that there is no God, that there is no reality other than nature, there are deep personal implications and deep implications in terms of your ability to understand any kind of moral framework at all. Naturalism just simply does not help us to understand the problem of evil. It eliminates the problem by saying there's no basis upon which to even define it. It's not very helpful. And for this reason, some people began to gaze to the East for insight, where in Eastern thinking, that is the bedrock of Hinduism, Buddhism, things like that, evil is simply the flip side of the good. You can't have good without evil. You can't have evil without good. And that's reflected, of course, in their concepts of divinity and of reality. So where on the one hand we have two totally equal yet opposite conceptions of God. On the one hand is Vishnu, the god of care and compassion, and on the other, Shiva, the god of death, destruction, war, and disease. And in the framework of the Hindu pantheon, which is again just ideologically the current of thinking that really defines Eastern thought, both of them are equally absolute, both are equally eternal, and it raises the question then, why would we call one thing good and the other evil? On what basis do we say Shiva's personification of violence and death and disease is somehow evil, whereas Vishnu's tenderness and kindness and care is good? There is no basis, if they are both equally absolute, if they are both equally God, to distinguish one from the other. And indeed, the reality is, if you believe that justice should prevail, for instance, or that goodness ought to triumph over evil, then you simply cannot accept this sort of pantheistic worldview. It doesn't answer the questions. It doesn't tell us why evil is something to be rejected, why evil is something to be conquered, because it is just as absolute and just as eternal and just as unchanging as the good. And so that brings us then, I think, to the third option, the one that really is rooted in the Bible and one that we want to explore in some detail here this morning, which is this, and that is that we live in a fallen world. That the world that we live in is not as God intended for it to be, and that evil fits into that conversation. Evil is a corruption or a distortion of something that God made good. In the Genesis creation account, in Genesis chapter 1, the repetition of the formula is really clear and repeated. It says in the that God created. In the first day, God said, it was, and then there's an assessment, it was good, because it comes from the creative, intentional hand of God. The second day, third, fourth, and so forth, same thing. God said, it was, and it was good. And the crown of God's creation is humanity in His image, which then brings us to the biblical understanding of the nature of evil, and which is that it is tied to the freedom and the choices of God's personal creation. If God is going to create human beings, that is to say, persons in His own image, that means that these beings, you and I, have to have the capacity to reason, the capacity to communicate, the capacity to form bonds with one another of love. We have to be able to make choices, because freedom is required of any personal being. The ability to enter into a love relationship is based upon our choosing a person to give our life to and to place their interests above our own. It is a choice that we must make. And so if God is to create beings in His own image, beings that are free, it carries with it then the very real risk that this freedom that God grants His creatures can be abused, can be used to serve not the purposes of the good, but to the purposes of the self, and to elevate one's own pride and one's own agenda over the needs and the interests of others in defiance to the plans and purpose of God. That has to be a part of what it means to be a person if we are to be persons. And God determined better to create human beings with freedom of choice than automatons, robots that had no freedom to act. And so, Genesis 2 tells us in verse 16 and 17, "From any tree of the garden you may freely eat, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat." So in a very concrete way, God is placing before Adam, the progenitor of our race, an option, a choice. You can do what you want, you're free, but here is a point of decision to either obey me or to disobey me, to use your freedom or to abuse your freedom. And that's a necessary condition for the expression of real personality, a real personhood. And here's the point in relation to the issue of evil, because we all know where this story goes from here. An all-powerful God, and God is all-powerful, could not, let's be clear here, could not prevent free beings from freely making evil choices. Yes, God is all-powerful. God can do anything that is possible to do. But there are some things even God cannot do, though he is all-powerful. He cannot make a square circle. It's a contradiction in terms. He cannot make 2 plus 2 equal 86. There are things that by nature are, by definition, they are what they are, and it's not a limitation on God's omnipotence that he can't make it otherwise. And so it is that God cannot create a free being who is totally capable of choosing, and on the other hand, create them in such a way that they always make the right choice. Because why? Because that's a contradiction to the very idea of freedom itself. So God creates humans in his image with the capacity to defy him, though he is omnipotent. And if we are truly free, and this is the important point, I suppose, here, that freedom requires that there are consequences. If we make a choice but are unable to act upon that choice, that choice has no change, in the reality around us, we'd say, well, that's not real freedom. And so, for instance, I may say, well, I want to fly to New York. Would like to do that. But if I don't have any money and no means to get to the airport and no plane will take me, am I really free? Of course not. Freedom requires that we are able to make choices, to take action, and that those actions we take affect the world around us. Once we understand this point, then we are in a place to really understand the unfolding of the biblical drama. Because in Genesis chapter 3, we learn that Adam and Eve, they make the choice to use their freedom to defy the will of God, and there will be consequences. It will affect the real world. Death and the corruption of nature are to follow, because God has said to Adam, in the day that you eat from this fruit, you shall surely die. You've become a mortal being in the sense that your body is going to give way. Your days are limited. They're numbered. You will die. You will become sick. Your body will be corrupted. And not only that, cursed is the ground because of you. And it was God's intent not only that the consequence of defying his design and his will and purpose for humanity would be their physical death, but also that even nature itself would not cooperate with the human agenda. Why? Why would an all-loving God bring these kinds of consequences to bear on the decisions of his humanity? And here I think there's a very important point here, that there's more to the story. God announces the consequence, and then at the end of the story in Genesis chapter 3, we're told this. It says, "Now Adam may stretch out his hand and eat from the tree of life and live forever." So God sent him out of the garden. It's a very interesting passage. And what does it tell us? It tells us that it is not God's intent for man to live forever in this now alienated, guilty, broken state, separated from God. That suffering and death really is not the worst possible outcome for humanity. Think about it. What if we live forever in the guilt that we carry, the unresolved issues within our character and in our relationships, with no ability to resolve these deep ingrained problems in our lives, and we just live this way, and all of humanity lives this way forever? What would you call that? Hell. That's hell. That's living forever in a totally broken state where we're given over without any limitation to our corrupted nature, to our self-interest at the expense of others, to our inherent sense of my rights and my interests at the expense of others' good. And God is saying, no, I'm going to put an end to that. That's not my intent for humanity. It's not going to go down like that. So suffering and death means that there is a window of time in which God is going to make a course correction here on behalf of humanity, that evil will not prevail. And that's for that reason, he brings to a limit the nature, the length of human life and the conditions under which we live. Now, I want to move to this story in a little bit more detail in just a minute, but I want to really make it clear at this point that what the Bible is describing is really, I think, something consistent with our own experience, and which is this, that there are noble and beautiful and good things that are true of humanity. We sense the value of all human beings, right? But we also are aware of the tragic flaws and failures that are a part of human history, human society, and when we're honest, you know, even in our own experience, we realize just how tortured and broken we really are. Both of these things are true, and they are uniquely explained in relation to the biblical view of nature and of evil and of the fall. We can lay forth and take our stand on the dignity and greatness of humanity. It's just as the Bible describes, we're in the image of God. But at the same time, are able to give voice to the fact that something is deeply corrupted and deeply broken. So I want to then move to a more personal part of our conversation before we bring this thing to resolution. Namely, that the abstract issue of the problem of evil is something that people debate and they take positions on and so forth. But it's a very different thing when the depths of the brokenness of the world and real suffering begin to close in on us. And there are questions that we begin to ask God. I was reading through the book of Job, thinking of all the questions that Job is asking, and the question that Job is asking God. There are two that really stick in my mind the most. The first is the questioning around, why is this happening to me? Right? When you begin to suffer and suffer in a significant way, that's almost the first question that people are asking. Why me? It seems so incredibly unfair. What have I done to deserve this? Right? Job puts it like this. He says, when I expected good, evil came. When I waited for light, darkness came. I am seething within and cannot relax. Days of affliction confront me. He's crying out to God, not fair. I was expecting goodness and evil came upon me. It just happened. And so now how do we handle this question? Why is this happening to me? Well, the virtually universal answer to this question is karma. the cosmic principle that says, quite literally, you get what you deserve. If you've done bad things happen to you. If you do good things happen to you. But here's something that's just extremely difficult for people who are really suffering to connect the dots in their life. How could it possibly be that the cancer that is beginning to overtake my body is the result of some kind of choices that I've made in my life? And Job's comforters, if you know the story, offer very little hope. They just keep reminding him, you get what you deserve. What have you done, Job? Admit your wrongdoing, then everything is all going to fit together. But Job is realizing, look, all of the losses that have taken place in my life, that I can't connect those in any way with things that I have done. It doesn't make sense. And so he turns his appeal to God. Why is this happening to me? And we realize, you know, the fact of the matter is the world is unfair. And things happen in this world not in a direct correlation with the things that we've done. Jesus himself says in Luke chapter 13, in verse 2, he says, "Do you think the Galileans were worse sinners than all the other people in Galilee when they were murdered by Pontius Pilate in the temple?" And he goes on and he says, "Remember the Tower of Siloam, when 18 people died when the tower fell upon them. Were they worse sinners than those in Jerusalem?" He says, "No, I tell you." Jesus is not teaching that you get what you deserve in that way. That's not how it works. The world is broken. And in that sense, things will happen to us that seem profoundly unfair. One of the most vivid and troubling images, memories I have is going to Haiti in 2010, just a couple of months after an earthquake that killed 250,000 people in a matter of seconds. And just the extraordinary destruction of virtually an entire city. And the pictures of a woman whose body was crushed up to her waist, pinned down by tons of concrete block, and she's flailing and seeking to get free, and she didn't get free, and she died, like thousands and hundreds of thousands of others. The world is unfair. And so we have to understand that God is dealing in a different framework here, not on the basis of fairness, but on the basis of grace. And here's the thing that I think that at a certain point, our instinctive thought about you get what you deserve needs to interact with something more deeply personal. I remember as a young man in high school, I went through a medical technology curriculum, and I became a lab tech, and I worked in a clinic out of high school, and I drew blood on hundreds and hundreds of people who were being treated for and ultimately would die of cancer. And I just thought, you know, what a drag that is, but that's just the way it is, and so forth. And then a weird thing happened to me. I decided to go to college and to try to flee some demons that had been kind of haunting my life for some years. And on April 1st, 1976, I woke up for school feeling really lousy. And as the day wore on, I felt worse and worse until by the end of the day, I could hardly breathe. What's wrong with me? Well, my mother takes me to the hospital. They begin to do x-rays, like, this is really weird. It becomes apparent that there's an air bubble in the pericardial sac of my heart, which is not life-threatening, especially to a 19-year-old. And I was in the cardiac care unit because they're waiting to see, should we aspirate this thing with a Pulp Fiction needle in my heart, or we'll wait for it to absorb. We don't really know what to do with this here right now. And I was laying there, and my roommate is the 80-plus-year-old Bud Larkins, the former athletic director at Ohio State. And for the first time in my life, I thought about suffering, and I thought about my life, and I thought about the inevitability of death in a different way. Not from the second hand, I'm sorry what's happening to those people, but what about me? And what's the difference between my life and this other man? And one day as I was thinking about that, who should darken the door of our room but the greatest of Bud Larkin's hires, which is Woody Hayes. He comes in, and my bed's closest to the door, and so he sees me, my eyes meet his. So now he's stuck, he has to talk. I have school books laying around. So you're a student? Yeah, my first quarter. Oh. Well, you know, we really need you on the practice field. So you need to get out of here as soon as possible. And so I can say truthfully that I was recruited by Woody Hayes to play Ohio State football. It's true. I was in your class that quarter, Ben. And after the evening wore down and everyone was left, I came to a place where I'm like, you know, I really hope that the world does not operate on the basis of fairness. Because if so, I am so screwed. Because when you have that kind of moment where you realize just how far you've drifted and how guilty you really are, it doesn't matter what the chain of causes are that brought you to the point that you're in. You just know that where I am is lost and broken. And you cry out for mercy. And that's what I did at that time of my life. That changed my life. That changed the whole trajectory of my life. The world's not fair. Thank God. Never ask God that He give you what you deserve. Okay? Well, we read on, or think on, about this. When we're suffering, we ask this question, where's God? Where's God in all of this? Job asked this question about the silence of God. He says, why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? I call out to you, but it's like I'm shouting into empty space. I hear no response. If I only knew why this was happening, it would enable me to really get that relaxed feel and embrace my suffering. We say to ourselves, we wonder, does God even care at all? These are the questions that Job brought before God. And God, as it turns out, answered the concerns of Job in such a way that Job is able to conclude the story, the resolution of Job's suffering. He says in Job 19, as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, that He will stand on the earth at last. And after my body has decayed, yet in my body I will see God. I will see Him with my own eyes. I'm overwhelmed at the thought. Let's think about this as we close here this morning. What is he saying? He's saying that he can call out to God because God is his Redeemer. What does it mean? It answers this question, where is God when I'm suffering? Well, God has come to us, and he's come to us as a redeemer. And redeemer is just kind of an old world word that means that the redeemer is one who buys the prisoner out of jail, who pays the cost of the offended on behalf of the guilty. So I make a terrible mistake. And now I owe $100 to my next door neighbor, but I don't have $100. But I have a friend who does. And that friend who pays the debt that I owe is my Redeemer. And the Bible teaches that God is our Redeemer, that in the free exercise of our will, as we have defied God, God has not abandoned us. Rather, He's moved toward us. And this is really what we're talking about when we talk about the cross of Christ. What happened at the cross? John the Baptist, in seeing Jesus, says, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." The root of evil, which is in the hearts of God's creatures, amounts to a debt that we cannot pay. That there's a bind that we cannot get ourselves out of. And all through the Old Testament is the picture of sacrifices of the innocent on behalf of the guilty. The innocent's life taken to atone for the sin of the guilty, to redeem them, to pay back what they owe. And John sees in Jesus the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, who lifts the burden of guilt from us all. And it is in the cross of Christ where love and justice finally intersect. Does God turn a blind eye to evil? He does not. He decisively addresses evil, judging evil. But he takes that judgment on himself in the person of Jesus Christ, the greatest act of love imaginable. And that is the core of the Christian message. And if you are here this morning and you're recognizing within yourself the profoundly unresolved state of your own heart and the dead alley of your own attempts to make yourself right, to make yourself better, and you've come to that place where you realize, I don't want what I deserve. I want mercy. God is here calling out to you this morning to say, just open your heart and reach out to your Redeemer and say, I want the death of Christ to be the death that I to pay for my sins. I want that death to cover my debt to God. And He will indeed forgive us and take new life within us, a redeemed new self that He's created for eternity. Where is God? God is on the cross. Is God silent? That's the concern that Job expressed. You know, I call out to you, but I get no answer. And yet God has not been silent. John tells us in John 1:14 that the Word became flesh and He lived among us. Think about this. God coming into the broken condition of the world that is in rebellion against Him. And He came into the backwoods of the backwoodsiest place in the Roman Empire, under conditions that were viewed as scandalous by anyone who was thinking about legitimacy and childbirth. He lived as a refugee in Egypt. He lived in a single-parent household, apparently, for a considerable amount of time. He lived as a poor man, a carpenter. He lived under impressive political circumstances. He made friends, close ones, and made himself totally vulnerable to them, only to be betrayed, to be brutally savaged, to be strung up on a cross and killed in the most disgusting way imaginable. Is God silent? Not at all. God has moved into the world of our complex, broken lives, lived in a way that when we call out to Him, we're not calling out into empty space, we're calling out to one who's been there, who knows the range of things that you and I have experienced. So personal was Jesus' own experience of the evil that we experience. We're told in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7, in the days of His flesh, He offered up fervent prayers with loud crying and tears. How many of us can identify ourselves in just that way to God? When we call out to Christ, we're calling out to one who knows exactly how we feel, who knows exactly what's going on in our hearts. And that, therefore, when Paul speaks of the intense suffering that he and many others were undergoing, he says that the God of all comfort comforts us in all our afflictions so that we comfort others in their afflictions. Now, maybe it's just a time of life. I guess it probably is. But I'm at a place now where my wife and I have had over a dozen pretty close friends go through breast cancer and have been able to watch their lives when they first met with a doctor who said, I think that there's a problem and we need to do some tests. To that really painful moment, that scary moment where they're sitting down in front of the doctor's desk and he says, I've got bad news for you and it's cancer. And then there are the therapies after therapies after therapies, the hair loss, the lumpectomies, the things that just brutalize the body. And you know, here's the thing that I have seen that is deeply profound, and which is that cancer removes the mask, removes the pretense that everything is okay, and helps us to see with astonishing clarity the temporal nature of our life and the brokenness of this world, and the goodness of a God who draws near to us as we seek Him out and plea before Him. And in case after case after case, with so many of these friends of ours, we have heard them say, even in the midst of significant pain and profound social awkwardness, that they would not trade this experience for anything because they've experienced God in a profound and transformative way. Evil is real, but God has overcome evil, and he gives us that victory. Let's make our last point. Job says, after my body has decayed, yet in my body I will see God. There's a triumph awaiting. There's a real hope. He has sentenced us to physical death so that death is an opportunity, so that it's not the end of the story, so we don't live on forever in this broken place. But there is a future coming to us. And as one who has reflected a lot about the nature of suffering and evil in the world and why these things happen to people in the way that they do, one of the passages of Scripture that I hold to tightly and that means so much to me comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Verse 12, where Paul says, now we see in a mirror, but soon face to face. Now I know only in part. I don't know the whole story. No finite mind can. But then I will know fully, just as I am fully known. My friends, evil is unavoidable. Denying that there is a God does not make suffering less. It makes suffering absurd, pointless. Here is an opportunity for us to understand that God has moved toward our suffering, has moved toward evil in a personal way, and has resolved, finally, rooted out the cause of evil, extends new life to us all, and is going to resolve history when he returns. So yes, there's a problem of evil. It's the unescapable problem of living in this world. But there's only one sober, clear, personally satisfying assessment to the problem of evil, and that is the God of the Bible and what he's done in Christ.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.